certainly the way they were described by the full court, full bench of the environment court, was the character proceedings for the interim plan. Now, would be a restricted discretionary activity that would enable some or all of the basic structuring elements of a development area to be established. You could lock it down to enabling all of those works, but as the provisions are currently framed, it's some or all. But the key is that you enable activity, you enable work, you enable something to occur, the land use to occur. The summary, that's my summary submission, stated that the subsequent applications for building would be a controlled activity provided they were consistent with the CEP resource consent. That is not correct. Buildings are a controlled activity per se, and then that activity status is not linked to the existence or otherwise of a CEP resource consent. However, any commercial, community, residential, or visitor accommodation activity accompanied by or in accordance with the CEP resource consent is a restricted discretionary activity. Now, the importance of that is it's the same activity status as the CDP resource consent. That's restricted discretionary, and development in accordance with it is also restricted discretionary. So we avoid the difficulty where activity status can't be determined on the face of the district plan. So that was one of the difficulties that came out of the Queenstown case, that if you had a discretionary activity, you put a CDP in future developments control or RDA. A regular plan doesn't know if the consent exists, so it doesn't know, they don't know what the activity status is on the face of the plan, so we avoid that issue by maintaining the state activity status. So by reason of the CDP type mechanism has been considered by the Environment Court in the QAC, Queensland Legislative Council case, and the court held that an outline development plan was invalid because it did not authorise a land use activity. So enabling those works remedies that shortcoming in previous CDP approaches. The CDP resource consent proposed under the QPSD will enable land use such as earthworks or vegetation clearance by reference to key structural elements, roads, landscaping, and development areas. In the context of the framework plan proposed under the unitary plan, the Auckland Unitary Plan, declarations were sought in the Environment Court as to the validity of the mechanism. And what I have here is a summary of how the hearings panel summarised the declaration proceedings, and I'll emphasise in brief summary the decision resulted in a declaration that the unitary plan may lawfully include a provision enabling an application for a bundle of land use consents which authorised the key enabling works necessary for development associated with the first stage of urbanisation or redevelopment of brownfield and greenfield land within precincts in the form set out in the attachments to the final decision. At 5.5, the independent hearings panel ultimately recommended the framework plan be deleted. However, as noted by it in the decision, Re-Auckland Council, the full court made a declaration that a rule enabling consent to apply for a bundle of land use activities that would authorise the key enabling works necessary for an integrated development of land is intra vires the Act. And I've just got the court's quote there. So what we say we have achieved, and might be other ways of drafting it, and Mr. Buxton's is a concern about its complexity, is a outline development plan, or whatever, a comprehensive development plan process that is lawful because it enables works, and the subsequent consents that rely on it are of the same activity status. Now, on the second leg, the Environment Court didn't make declarations on that second question, so that's still an area of unsettled law, but it was a concern raised in the Queenstown Lakes District Council case, so we'll try to avoid that issue in any case, even though the law's not settled on that. The only thing I'll also add, and it's not in my written submission, is during the Auckland Council case, Roy Somerville QC was appointed as amicus, and he advanced an argument that you could have a CDP type process as an informational requirement for a consent, and the court didn't expressly reject that, but they didn't accept that as being a way forward. So it's set out as Dr. Somerville's submission, and it's not expressly excluded, but it's not included in the declaration that they made. So we have avoided using it as an informational requirement as well, solely. We've gone on the track of it has to authorise some works, and that's the key part of our CDP proposal. That's right, Steve, you might have some questions on that. I'm more than happy if you don't, but if you do,
we could say that since the start.
Yeah, well, of course, and there is, they're both the legal requirements and how it hangs together in the provisions as drafted, so we'll see how that goes. So urban development, and we've had an exchange with Commissioner Malcolm, with all of you about urban development, but what I say here is that the Queenstown Park Special Zone is a special zone. It is predominantly rural, but will have urban elements such as the village station. Rebecca Skidmore considers that the Queenstown Park Special Zone development does not meet the definition of urban development in the PDP. The vast majority of the site is open space and rural. Mr. Brown acknowledges that there are peri-urban and urban elements in RB3, but any landscape change within the bounds of the wider landscape setting. Notwithstanding, obviously it's a view for you to reach, but if you reach the view that the urban elements it was necessary to exclude those or to acknowledge those urban elements, you could exclude the Queenstown Park Special Zone from the definition of urban development, as has been done for Waterfall Park and Millbrook. And I'm sorry if I confused that away. I'm not saying that the zone is like those zones, but the mechanism of getting around the growth boundary in terms of urban development could be the same. Of course, you have to reach the view that it'll be the definition of urban development as proposed in the plan too. And that was something we just pursued earlier in the hearing process to jurisdictionally make it available to the committee if it thought it needed it. Building restriction, Mr. Buxton's spoken about that and seems to agree that it could be deleted, but he's raised a scope issue. And I haven't had a chance to go back to our submission to check that, but I will do that, and if that's acceptable, update you on that during the course of the hearing process. Acceptable to you?
Given that just catch it, it's probably only a metre or two, because unformed road is the bulk of the land.
Yes, we always wondered why. Why it was there, we looked at the stormwater pond. Mr. Buckley was given some assistance, but perhaps being curious, in my view, if there's a restriction with no basis, then we shouldn't have it. But I'll go back to the submission and check that. At Section 8, I deal with conservation land. In the Gondola Corridor Park is over land administered by the Department of Recreation. The Department of Conservation has recreation and conservation land. It cuts just a small portion of conservation land. We're really talking about the width of lines on maps there, so it's almost exclusively recreation reserve. And of course, the actual gondola structure won't require the entire width of the corridor. Something within that corridor. More than likely, where it's been modelled because of the work Mr. Spears has done on that line. The Gondola Corridor is almost entirely within the Rep Reserve, except part of Apparatus Burn, as I've just mentioned. This does not provide my submission the impediment to providing a corridor overlay over this land. A concession will be required for the establishment of the gondola when resource consent is sought. Initial preliminary discussions have occurred, and they've been positive, but they are initial discussions. It would be, you'll be aware that the resource legislation MLAC is aligning consent and concession processes.
No,
oh,
I mean, I'm not ignoring it. It's not relevant to these hearings.
Well, it does. It comes on the 18th of October.
But not yet. But it has no effect on our decision-making process.
No, but I only mention it in terms of thinking more about consenting processes, that those two projects, if the zone was put in place and you were consenting it, you would have a similar process with a dock concession as well.
Then they become aligned.
Yeah, yes, that's right. So that was the only reason I mentioned that. I'm happy not to give it to that. Everything it does.
That's why I think anyway.
No, we can do that. Although I do have to touch on the notification point as well. The Water Conservation Kawarau Order 1997 is addressed by both Mr. Buxton and Mr. Sargent. Mr. Buxton's evidence relies on that order to assert that the Kawarau River is an outstanding natural feature. But I think the reality is, again, under Section 6B and 6C, you'll be looking at the values of that river and you've got evidence on it and you'll be thinking about it. And I don't think there's a need to get too technical about the relevance of the Kawarau Order. It really sits in there when you go to consent the structure of the river that's going to fight, such as the training wall in the Shot Over River, in the case about that. In my submission, I think you have adequate evidence on the values of that river to reach a view about whether its values are protected or not. But I just noticed that one of the key parts of that order is the recreational use of the river, which we say we facilitated or enhanced by the Queensland Park Special Zone, and just note there the contact recreation purpose, Class CR7.
Just on that though, the question I have, and it comes up when Mr. Sargent said it is too, which is the approach that with land use as a water conservation order is not particularly apposite. Are you familiar with the Southland Fish and Game decision of the Environment Court, where they refused consent for a cycle trail because of the effects,
completely contrary with the order,
would undermine the characteristics sought to be protected by the conservation order, which is a different thing, had nothing to do with the water.
No, and I haven't looked at the actual order to see what it said about what the features were and what the protections were in that order. I'm familiar with the decision, but I haven't quoted them here. The reality is that if a jetty consent is sought by Queensland Park and Island Zone, and it is alleged, or there's evidence called that it offends the order, then that jetty might not succeed.
Yes, but what if it's a land use such as cycle trail that alters the wild and scenic characteristics? Because that's essentially what the court said in Southland.
Well, isn't it? Well, it'll depend on what the protections are, I guess, of the order, so I'll need to look at that and get at what you have in this particular order, because here we talk about damming being prohibition intended to give effect to those characteristics, and that's why, of course, with the training wall, which was a structure in the water, there was a close evaluation of this order. So I need to take it further and to close out, I need to look at that decision and see exactly what the values were. But what I have, in terms of this order, I have quoted passages here that say that this is about protection of water, not the protection of land. Now, there might be some different views about how the Environment Court's approach, and I can come back to you on that again if that's...
Yes, well, I mean, I've in the past have taken the approach that Mr. Sargent has said, and this decision, the Environment Court seems to say that we need to take rather more notice of the remedial and land use applications or zoning, etc.
It goes to the extent of zoning, not just the two.
Well, this case was a land use application, but it was.
Because, like I said, by the resource consent stage, I can't take it through this, so I'll need to look at the decision, but. As I said earlier in terms of our Section 6 directives, the values of that river and its margins are in front of you anyway, under Section 6A, B and C. But I will make a decision to see if we can maintain our position in terms of the water conservation corridor, because it's always been my understanding it's about the water.
Yes, rather than, for instance, the Gondola going across the top of it, or something happening beside it.
So even with that too, in a gondola going over a river or along a river, where you get to view the river, connect with the river, is a recreational activity connected to the river. So it's not, it's how far do you go in terms of, is it just someone smoking here, swimming in it, paddling on it, or someone going over it? And what I say to you, it's all of that. And everyone that's connected to the river and enjoying it from a recreational perspective, because they get to see it, and they get to see the colour of it or the movement of it, and that's a recreational activity connected to the river, and the water itself is encouraging those things, provided you manage those characteristics as well. Now, in terms of notification, and I'm back to the Resource Legislation Amendment Act 2017, and I'm not particularly helpful in my submission here because it's not clear whether the directives on notification would apply to rural residential activity. My view is that wasn't the intent of the Act, but the Act's plain words aren't clear to exclude that. To cut through that, in terms of the state of play now, and dealing with your point about it not being retrospective, once they view that your views on notification again can come, what we reach, the views you reach on the notification rule as proposed can come back to the evidence in front of you, and you don't need to be guided by this because of the lack of clarity, although there is the amendment that will clearly apply to subdivision. For that subdivision per se, in a rural zone, it's not limited by residential activity. So I think we all know what central government is intending in terms of speeding up processes. It's the act itself has been as focused as it's intended to be.
The other query I've got in that section is you make in paragraph 10.1, you say that Mr. Sain notes that Chris Sain hasn't given rise to any opposition from the general public. Given that to lodge a further submission, you have to be directly affected these days, isn't that an unsurprising circumstance?
Well, I was pretty surprised by the lack of public opposition.
There's no public interest group in this town.
No, but we all know Queenstown pretty well, and people are interested in these things and are involved, and it's a much more active town than many others. Whether it's the airport, contours, whatever it might be, there are public objections and public residential groups getting involved. My personal view is I hoped that there'd be some public support, but I was surprised at the lack, just as people being interested in what was happening.
So who would be directly affected?
Well, no, in terms of primary submission. I thought there'd be primary submissions out there expressing a view on this proposal. But in terms of who is directly affected, well, the person has to prove they're directly affected. And so whether someone like Hayes says, well, I'll be directly affected for the very reasons that Ms. Mouse said, you wouldn't, well, they haven't said that, but they could have, and then they have to show that.
Isn't it likely that the parliament changes is just when people think you have to be, you know, the form is saying that you have to show how you're directly affected on the form, and you look at them and say, well, it's not on my land.
It certainly doesn't encourage people to submit like they may have, but no, I don't think it's quite as powerful as that. I think people still are interested and care about what's happening near and around them, and as I say, in this district, people are fairly active. But I take your point, it's not the system it once was, but...
I mean, in reality, you've got very few further submissions.
Well, see, I didn't know that, whether across the plan you had relatively few further submissions. But given the significant tourism economic development and the location of the proposal, we had expected people to perhaps have something to say. We'd hope that there'd be submission and support, and there were a few, but if they're, when we're talking about notification too, is that direct adverse effect that most likely going to be relevant to your resource consent rather than a matter of public interest or public motives of thought? So you have a similar constraint potentially on.
It might not be relevant on the first one, but it may be on the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth.
That's right.
It's increasingly an issue, yes.
Yeah, so I guess that's a matter, again, it's like the evidence and the role and what's the comfort or not the human aspects of the proposal. But I'll give that some further thought too in terms of first issue. But no, perhaps maybe we thought there would be more public interest than there was, and we took that as a positive indication that this was seen something that could be good for the district and people like, and still do take that view to some extent. Precedent concerns, Mr. Buxton has clarified, and I think it's fair, it's probably a slightly semantic issue in terms of whether it's precedent, in the sense that we know in resource management law, in terms of effects on integrity of district plan, but my submission here is precedent doesn't usually arise in zoning applications. But again, whether this is a thin end of the wedge or whether you have concerns about what this means for other pieces of land is a matter you can consider. Mm. But the way we've dealt with that in the evidence is to say there are a number of unique factors in terms of location of the land and the resource that it's connecting. And not least too, that it's a significant undertaking to contemplate something like this and to pursue a zoning like this as well. So I don't think
it is something that at least three or four other stations have raised some of the uniqueness about our station
decisions,
and we need something special. So
when you think of that ski field and the urban area so close to it and the opportunity to connect people with the gondola, there's a logic to that obviously, and that's not present throughout the district. You've got the urban area, an urban zone, you've got the Franklin Flats that could be fit for the ski field in this Alpine area. But yes, it's not uncommon for people to identify unique factors of their land, but also from an infrastructure perspective, the co-location in the existing urban area is something that's quite unique in terms of access and being able to get to it, just a matter of minutes away from an urban area to get this remote experience. But to say those things are touched on and set out in Mr. Sargent's evidence as well in terms of precedent. Now section 12, I think I agree with what Commissioner Mountford said. At the end of the day, as a matter of law, you can turn your mind to people's and policies for restricted discretionary activity if they are, people have different views on whether they assist with your assessment of the matters that have been identified for discretion, and whether you have a view that they're clear enough on their face. So one of the drivers for including these objectives and policies as a matter for discretion was to give the council some comfort that they were able to look at these things in enough detail, and that's important to the council's confidence in minutes of the plan. I personally, from a legal perspective, don't have a great strong argument whether in or out, because as a matter of law, you can look at them anyway. But having the certainty, that's right. But having the certainty that they're in there and directing you to them, that might be a perceived benefit or a real benefit, and having them actually in there, and then you might remove the argument that no, this policy isn't relevant because that criteria is clear on the space. There has been further work on the matters for discretion, and they address landscape in some detail now. But again, I'm not wedded to either way, but it's a technique or method by which to give some more comfort around the outcomes for those CDPs and POPs. And we wouldn't accept the proposition that the objective policies aren't clear enough on their face, but of course that's something that you will explore and form a view on in the course of the hearing. Now the gondola within the RPZ, we talked about this earlier on in my submissions, and that the structure of that nature can be built there, but it is outside the Queenstown Park Special Zone, which does have the implication that the directions about the gondola that affect the land that would be zoned Queenstown Park Special Zone aren't in the RPZ. So you build the structure on the basis of the objectives and policies in that zone. And that's something we'll all give some thought to, because I know that's something you've raised.
They're not in the rules, are they?
No, well, not yet. No, they're not. But you have the rural zone, but you have the scope maybe later. But you do have a rural zone that currently, I suppose, anticipates passenger lift systems with a series of considerations that are deemed adequate there. What we've tried to do is give much more certainty about where this is going to be, and we know that by the corridor. What are the sensitivities there, what are the characteristics you need to look to preserve to give this more certainty and more shape than simply the rural zone generally. But in the rural zone,
the question I have is what do you do about bundles?
Well, you put the consent, there'll be one consent. I think that the reality is going to be, if you can't meet the more stringent requirements of the Queensland Park Special Zone, you don't have the link to complete your gondola. So it's going to have to achieve what it's meant to achieve in terms of that ONL through the Queenstown Park Special Zone. And if you can't design it and put it in the place and do what you said you're going to do, you have the commencement and the termination of the gondola, nothing in between. But that's the essential, the metropolis in there, and that's the essential part. but you have consents under each zone. And the bundling in terms of activity status, because that's the question you're the most onerous activity status would have to apply unless you judge to carve off a part of it. But that's in the exchange we had this morning, and I've had some discussion with our expert today, we'd like to give that some further thought too. But it's achievable, it's whether you have some integrated package in terms of how you're looking at assessing those applications, and it can make it easier. And I'd also like to think about what scope you might have to have a Queenstown Park gondola specific matter in a rural zone or in a steerer subzone. I think the steerer subzone is not the difficulty. We talked about extending that and whether you have something specific in that zone. But I think that's a scope issue, and I need to look at that too, if there was a way to address that potential. So in conclusion, well, I think everything I meant to say in conclusion I've probably said and answered the questions to the panel. But we submit there that the Queenstown Park Special Zone is better than rural zone, and a key reason for that is that it is a bespoke zoning tailored to the unique features of the site. The gondola presents a significant tourism opportunity and the economic benefits are substantial. That bears emphasis that the recreation, visitor accommodation, glamping and village development also offer opportunities to contribute to Queenstown's tourism offering. This zone consolidates and enhances existing and highly valued recreational activities such as the trail network and the ski area. In addition to tourism benefits, the gondola is important transport infrastructure, and the proposal is supported by NZ Ski and QPL traffic expert for the contribution it will make to reducing car use and road network pressure. The O&L within which the QPSZ will be located already contains cultured elements in the Queenstown Park Special Zone enables sensitive development in specific locations. It offers superior ecological and water quality outcomes in the rural zone. Looking further, sir, the three waters question you've raised, and we'll give you further assistance on that. 14.6, I'll just note the provisions have been further refined, and of course they can continue to be so through this process too. And finally, Mr. Sargent has identified provision for tourism as a key growth, tourism growth as a key issue for the district. And that appears in my submission to be an undeniable statement of fact. That being so, it's imperative that the district plan make express provision for tourism infrastructure and development in Queenstown, some of which must inevitably be located within land identified as an O&L. And just, of course, yeah, we're in this situation, so we've got recommended council positions, but of course you've got decisions to make and across a number of chapters, so you have no certainty exactly precisely what the objective of the policy framework will be. However, Matthew Pates and his reply evidence introduces strategic direction objective that says the significant socio-economic benefits of tourism activities across the district are provided for and enabled. Now, whether that survives or not is not, I don't know, but certainly this proposal is right in the sweet spot of that particular objective from the tourism benefits perspective. I know there's much more to this case than that, but just to emphasise that point.
On that, even if that objective survives in that point, it doesn't follow that each and every proposal that comes forward ought to be approved.
No, it will be assessed on its merits with the competing tensions that are evident and the competing evidence. However, though, in terms of being the most appropriate to give effect to the objectives, there's an objective there that clearly anticipates this type of development. The question is, irrespective of the Queenstown Park Special Zone, are the district plan provisions delivering on that objective or that type of objective across the district anyway? And if they are they doing enough or too much of it? So just to really identify that from the council identifying a strategic policy outcome, we have support in principle for what we're looking at here. But I appreciate the point you make that there are other factors to be considered. And just finally, if it assists, I haven't spoken to the reporter about this, but as the evidence comes out, we can arrange a further site visit if you want to get out there again. That's not a problem. So if over the next couple of days you thought it was a benefit, I think we can do that pretty quickly.
So
we'll discuss that amongst ourselves.
Just to make an offer of it. So those are my submissions. Thank you for your patience and questions. Unless there are any more questions, I would locate Mr. Brown.
So I think that's a discussion issue on the last paragraph. Provision for growth, tourism growth is a key issue for the district. I was a little intrigued by this technique of formulating an issue. I mean, it's not necessary, is it, to do that?
No, it isn't. Mr. Stadler's evidence acknowledges that identifying issues is not necessary. It's not something that the Act requires necessarily, but he says, and I agree, that it's a good technique to test what it is that you're putting forward. It's certainly something that can be relevant because, of course, that particular issue has got to be relevant to sustainable management in Queenstown and economic and social well-being. But
it sort of makes the assumption that Queenstown isn't sustainable if it doesn't continue to grow.
No, that's not how we intended. What we're saying is that there will be increasing pressure on the tourism resources of this district. Growth projections are what they are, they won't be accurate in total, or they may not be, but in order to look forward sustainably in terms of tourism development or tourism demand in Queenstown, we need to look at these sort of things. Now, I'm not saying this is a solution to all of Queenstown's problems, but in the context of that strategic issue, these are the kind of zones that you have to contemplate. And here you've got a programmer putting his hand up saying, look, we see that challenge, tourism growth in the future, here's that infrastructure for our ski fields as part of what the district's about, and this is our solution.
There's an argument that more growth actually could add to Queenstown's present problems.
Well, it could if you don't. If you don't zone or provide the infrastructure necessary to respond to it. It's an interesting point. There is a view that you might want to choke demand to preserve what you've got, but I don't see that as being the council's strategic position. So I think that's important. I don't understand that to be anyone's strategic position, and if that was, I think you need to be very clear about that. But as I understand it, this district is saying we're planning for growth. There's always got to be a balance on that, but we're not looking to choke growth at this point. I mean, yes, the reality is that it'd be a highly controversial approach to your planning to choke off demand. Whether it's right or wrong, it would be quite a difficult thing to advance, I'd imagine.
The fact that council hasn't adopted that specific provision doesn't to say that the consequence could occur anyway. I mean, there are huge constraints at the moment, the airport being one, the state of the road in the other, the amount of visitor accommodation that's available in the place, things like that.
Mm.
Just building more on something that providers and they will come could create a whole lot more issues.
It could. I don't think, it's not for me to express a view on whether it would or wouldn't as an expert, not an expert, but the issue, even to go to a higher level, there isn't a strategic document that is directing this council or council of the Otago region to carefully look at limits on tourism development and growth. I think so. If I go back to the Act and what we have to give effect to and how we are implementing objective policies, the submission I make is that there's a clear strategic approach here. But
it's also, to me, quite a big jump to say, having identified that issue, seems to say that this proposal is the best way of addressing it.
Well, we're not saying it's the best way, but it's a better way than the rural zone of addressing it. And what we do say is someone somewhere has to address it, and we've done the work to address it and to present it to you, and as I say, I keep saying, you'll form a view on that work. There could be myriad ways of addressing it, but the vast majority of them may never come in front of you because they're not pursued. And I would respectfully say, I think it's unlikely you'll see a council promote a plan change, or, sorry, a plan review that looks at this sort of element of knowing out in a way that's not, it's almost not the council's role to advance that, and you don't see that very often, it's often from the private sector. But I guess what I'm trying to say is all you can do is evaluate what's in front of you whilst bearing in mind the social life. If not here, if we don't go with this, where is the plan delivering on that strategic objective in Queensland in terms of tourism growth? Because I take the point that that could deliver problems. In fact, it's any growth inevitably presents challenges. But in the context of the policy framework we're in, we have to deal with those problems, not try and prevent them, because the growth has been encouraged. We're zoning land, that the airport's looking at expansion, that's going in that direction. There may be a time in the future where that changes, but it's not the current state of play in my submission, in my view.
Is that something that we would look to Chapter 3 for direction on, being the strategic direction of Chapter
3? Yes. Because I think that's right. I mean, that's going to set the scene. And like the point you made to me about the landscape chapter, if the strategic direction chapter was to contract in terms of what it anticipated and what it was encouraging, that it was well on effect. You've heard submissions in our view on what that should say, and of course that's in your hand as well. Well, I hope it's been a helpful exchange, and I will call Mr. Brown. I'll just clear some space so we've got some room. I had a summary statement on the agenda.
Concepts would affect the remarkables for Kauai River Valley
and the Allen-Alden embraces the Georgia. Importantly, the gondola project would not affect the iconic western face of the Remarkables, but would instead focus on the Coorong River Valley and the range of more peripheral northern slopes around the Rastersburn stream catchment. These extend upwards to culminate in the existing Remarkables ski area. The various tourism and rural residential nodes proposed would primarily occupy the terraces next to the Coorong River, sitting above it, well below the main slopes of the northern Remarkables. The Gondola proposal has the potential to affect a large number of receiving environments and a broad range of both public and private audiences. However, because of various environmental factors pertaining to the Gondola's location, its landscape setting and backdrop, and the nature of its key structural elements, this does not translate into a high level of visibility or effects. Instead, the gondola would have a low to very low level of impact on most areas completely exposed to the system. Viewed at quite close range, in areas including Lake Hayes Estate and the Arrowtown and Gibson Valley Cycle Trail, it would remain a relatively lightweight, even ephemeral component of the Coorong River Valley. Even where elevated well above the river corridor, traversing the higher slopes that flank the Rastersburn, the gondola system would float relatively lightly above its alpine setting and would have little impact on public perception and appreciation of the Remarkables. The proposed RV and RR development areas would be more substantial. Yet they would also be more discreetly located within the river corridor below the Remarkables' main slopes, and more elevated touch of grasslands. As such, they would primarily impact productive rural land close to the river and wood, with the exception of the RV3 tourist village, be substantially buffered from most areas of significant public activity. Although visible from Lake Hayes Estate in particular, views of the proposed tourist village would frequently be contextualised by the existing residential properties and dwellings next to most vantage points. Existing riverside trees, terrace banks above and lining the Coorong River, together with a range of other factors, would further contribute to both screening of the proposed development and its integration into parts of the valley's landscape that become increasingly enclosed and difficult to access both visually and physically as one progresses towards Charred Farm. Revised provisions. In my evidence in chief, I also state that I feel the proposed QPSZ provisions offer council the means to achieve integration of this development into its landscape setting. However, in this regard, I must acknowledge that some of the concerns raised by Ms. Melsop, both in her rebuttal statement and at expert conferencing with myself and Rebecca Skidmore, This has resulted in recent amendments to the proposed provisions, most notably to Rule 4448, addressing activities within the rural visitor activity areas and R3, and the development of additional criteria for subdivision under Rule 2757. From my point of view, these changes address the gaps identified by Ms. Melsop. Ms. Melsop has raised a number of concerns about both the proposals and has taken issue with some of my assessment findings in her rebuttal evidence. I have responded to the concerns raised by Ms. Melsop in my own supplementary statement, and in particular I have acknowledged those that pertain to the proposed QPSZ rules as described above. Even so, it would be fair to say that Ms. Melsop and myself have agreed to continue to disagree in relation to some of my findings. Notwithstanding some of the points raised by her, it therefore remains my opinion that the QPL proposals must inevitably alter parts of the landscape in the vicinity of the Northern Remarkables, more so in close proximity to the Coorong River, but that such changes would occur without degrading or appreciably eroding the core values associated with the Remarkables O&L as a whole. As such, it remains my view that the combined QPL-RPL proposals are acceptable from a landscape standpoint. That's my summary statement.
So, with regard to the visual simulations we've been giving, the respect to the goals, I think we'll be discussing those with the author of them.
Yes.
But why was that exercise not extended to include all the activity points?
Because at that stage nobody had any idea exactly what form of development and what configuration would occur in relation to those nodes.
Couldn't it have been done on a sort of a best case, worst case scenario?
No. And the reason I say that is that there is still a lot of uncertainty over exactly how you would distribute, for instance, the 90 residential units amongst the various rural residential nodes.
Well, that raises the question of how you came up with the figure of 90.
I didn't.
Or whoever did.
It is all distributed.
Yes, but the numbers, they're not, they're sort of stating what the maximum is for. Right?
It would have been, I don't know, it seems uneven that you've got one of the two major components treated that way and the other not.
Well, I think the reality is that there is a degree of precision about the gondola system that's reflected in the simulations that simply couldn't be applied in terms of either the RV3 village or the other rural residential nodes. I'm sort of discounting RV4 at this point because it's a very small scale, it's low lying, and it's both visually and physically very true. But it would have been incredibly difficult to actually model those because there's a world of difference, for instance, between development which involves individual residential units, even if they're going up to two stories, versus those that start to be clustered or combined into the likes of townhouse-type developments or terrace units.
If you did it conceptually, you run the risk of misleading us because it would be like that.
Well, there are so many permutations on what might occur that it would be very difficult to say which is the most correct version.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only thing we can really say in relation to the terraces is that certainly in relation to the RV3 area, you have one area where you're likely to have slightly greater intensity, which is on the lower terrace, and that might more consistently go up to, say, three stories. But on the upper terrace and in the other rural residential nodes, it's more likely to be more spread out development, and it's more likely to go to up to two stories in general.
Changing tack a bit. The moment on that south bank.
Sorry?
At the moment on that south bank, you'd agree, wouldn't you, that there's nothing but rural development?
Yes.
Other, you know, stops about Boyd's,
yes,
the house off Boyd's Road, and nothing else occurs until Chad's Farm, which arguably itself is rural.
That's absolutely correct. There's some old...
There's some sheds, yeah.
There's some sheds, and there's the farm manager's house, and some associated farm buildings with that, but otherwise. And you've also got a couple of barns near the RV3, on the RV3 terraces.
And that stretches for about 10 kilometres, doesn't it? Well, I've needed it, so.
Yes.
And
the gondola system is 10.
Yeah, but that goes up the road.
That's right.
Goes around the corner, doesn't it? So that's not quite. It does go 10 kilometres down to. And RV3 itself is only 4 kilometres down.
Oh, sorry, I see what you mean. Yes. Yes.
So you're extending. And RV3 is opposite Fakes, which is about the southern, about the furthest extent downriver on the north bank.
That's correct. There's,
so you've got quite a lot of, you've got a string of development which is purely confined to the south bank.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. But the flip side of that is that it's also in the most contained part of the valley corridor until you really get into the unbuildable part, which is getting close to the Chard Farm. But I mean, by that I mean that you're getting into the part of the valley system which is much more confined, both physically and visually. So on one hand, it's a disadvantage for the reason that you've outlined, because you're sort of extending into new frontiers as far as that development goes, but at the same time you're extending into part of the valley catchment that is more isolated both physically and visually from most public areas.
With the, isn't that isolation an important part of the characteristic of the landscape?
I don't think you don't get the same degree of isolation as you might going up the Dark River or going into any of the other river corridors around both Wakatipu and Wanaka.
But that was close to the urban area.
That's right.
The very point was just a young lady.
Mm. But you're never completely isolated from. I mean, we're treating the river system as if it's a completely natural landscape, and of course that's not the case. It's very much, in fact, a product of human intervention. It's a cultural landscape. Presently we see it as a largely farmed landscape with, on the northern side, a mixture of farms, rural residential development, now cycleways, walkways, transmission lines and so on, extending into the suburban pockets of Lake Hayes and shot over the country.
Who's the rural residential on the north side?
There are, well, I think you only have to look at the scattering of residential development that you see either side of State Highway 6, and it certainly has the characteristics of rural residential development.
But that's downstream of the confluence of the Yarrow River.
That's right.
But we're talking about upstream of that confluence, aren't we?
Yes, we are. But I think what I'm really saying is there is no complete sense of isolation. There's no sense of complete remoteness. It's a highly appealing landscape. There's absolutely no question of that. But for the most part, it's experienced in a very dynamic fashion. Most people who travel through this landscape are either doing so by cycling, walking, or jet passing. And so what they actually experience is a mixture of natural and cultural landscapes. The more elevated peaks, the more elevated parts of both the Crown Range and the Remarkables provide that natural context, but the landscape within the valley floor and around the Kawarra River Valley itself is all modified. You don't have, for instance, the natural beech forest, which would have once existed through that area. It's basically been completely removed.
You don't have the glacier that was once there either.
No, we don't. But the beech forest is found in areas around here, as we well know.
At least they can reduce it, possibly.
Yes. But the point I'm making is that this is a landscape that has been changed. And by the time you get into the Gisborne Valley, you're very aware of that. Because the Gisborne Valley, for instance, is an area that's characterised by human intervention.
The valley is not over now, though, is it? Not in
the
Gisborne Valley zone.
No.
I think I'm going to move on to the importance of a public viewpoint of that cycleway across the face of Morgan Hill.
Yes.
And you seem to treat it rather lightly.
No, I don't think I treat it lightly, but what I accept is that the cycleway again offers a range of experiences. And those experiences aren't confined to just looking at a natural landscape. In fact,
there's a difference though. I mean, particularly at the south, at the downstream end, where you come out of the deer farm.
Yes.
And those couple of viewpoints here, it's an outstanding view of the whole valley, and the only thing that spoils it really is the lights on the end of the airport runway. which we don't really think about. But you can see the whole length of this development, practically. And, all right, it's farm, as you say.
But it's more than farm.
Yes, I accept the point that there's farming there, but is the addition of 90 rural residential dwellings, plus whatever is going to be built in the RV areas, I think they're substantially different visually, much more intrusive than farming?
It's certainly a change.
But a more intrusive change.
But I mean, you say that, and it's easy to look at developments and say, okay, all development represents an adverse effect. But, I mean, this is an area or part of the country where the combination of natural features, natural landscapes, and cultural elements is often expressed in a very powerful way, and probably Walt Peak Station is the epitome of that. But you also see it in places like the Cadrona Valley too. And there's an acceptance that if the development sits in that landscape in an appropriate fashion, then it can sit there in a way that actually still is integrated with that landscape and complements it. So,
well, I think that doesn't stretch for 10 kilometres in a line, does it?
No, nor does the development that's proposed.
Oh. And well, I think might vary on that.
I think, well,
I'm being a devil's advocate here, when you realise.
Of course, but the point I made, and the point I made very strongly in my evidence, was that this was a series of no's, in particular two no's, because you have the combination of RV3 and RR2, and then you get the combination of RR, part of RR3, RR4, RR5 and 6, with RV4 again in another node. And
say that again.
My feeling.
Say that again.
Yes.
The two nodes.
The two nodes focus on RV3 and RR2.
Yes.
And then effectively, the second grouping comprises the remaining RR nodes or groups and RV4. And so from my point of view, as a landscape architect, it was quite important that there was that sense of definition and separation between them. That was also one of the reasons that, I think it really is quite important that we look at this issue of, for instance, planting both within and around these nodes, so that there is a greater sense of integration of the development that does occur with its surrounds.
Does it bother you that the planting could be practically anything under the pavement?
I think it's quite a strong focus now on the revised provisions in terms of ecological enhancement and integration with the natural patterns of that existing landscape.
And that can be assessed at what stage?
That's really at the point when they are assessed as a restricted discretionary activity.
For the activities. I mean, what's your understanding of the rules here? Where
the point of
you're basically as long as I'm here.
It's basically the point of application for subdivision consent.
There's a controlled activity. The council could have some influence on what was to be planted if it wanted to.
Well, I think it's more than that. Because if you have a look at the revised provisions, which were provided by Mr. Sargent, in terms of 44.48, the revised provisions, comprehensive development activities, for the rural visitor activity areas and rural residential activity area 3,
yeah,
specifically refers to
assessment against the following, including opportunities to enhance existing indigenous vegetation, such as Matagari and landscape features of the development area, such as the river terraces, terrace rises and escarpments, using both indigenous plant communities of the zone and a range of exotic deciduous planting.
So just Mr. Brown's working off the clean version on the track change, just in case you get any page numbers.
And then in rural visit activity area 3, landscape and planting strategies both within and around the activity area to integrate the village with its wide setting, reinforce the natural landscape patterns, and create structure and visual breaks to development using both plants that are indigenous to the area and exotic species. Now I think that's accepting that there will need to be the use of some exotic, perhaps deciduous species, for instance, within the areas of development, but certainly around the margins and in terms of integration with the wider landscape, I would assume the extensive use of indigenous plants.
A bit optimistic.
Sorry?
A bit optimistic.
Well, it's optional insofar as it's part of the assessment of the whole package. And I think those are quite important considerations. And I note that in relation to the additional criteria proposed for 2757, the subdivision within the QPSZ, Mr. Sargent has suggested a number of additional criteria, and those include responsive development patterns to landscape values both within the activity area and in the surrounding context, planting and other landscape treatment that responds to the landscape values and rural character of the area, and maintenance of rural character. And I think that would rely on both the location, distribution of development, but also the way in which any mitigation, including planting, is undertaken.
All of those provisions seem to have rural character as being the important.
I was thinking that straight out of Parliament, they saying rural character very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
That might be completely inappropriate.
Well, it might be, but the trouble is that you've already got at least one major pine shelter belt on the RR4 node, backing onto the RR5 node. You've got poplars, you've got willow, you've got a raft of exotic weed species from broom and rosebriar to goodness knows what found throughout the river margins. So,
but do we want to perpetuate this?
No, we do not, and that's the point I'm really making. It is time to address a lot of these issues.
But any of that, because it's part of the existing landscape, would satisfy those criteria?
No, it wouldn't.
Why not?
Because they're weeds.
But that doesn't say so.
Well, we're not suggesting that you go planting rosebriar to address the issue of integration with the surrounding landscape. And I think this is really where the input from the ecologists is also of extreme importance, because this isn't just about plonking developments on the landscape, it's trying to bed that development into the landscape and working with the natural systems that are found there. It certainly has some advantages over allowing cattle just to keep running up into the areas of tussock land, which has been the practice in the past. It's not at the moment, but it has occurred. And the signs of that are clearly apparent.
What Now, I want to shadow this morning. I want to address this contextual thing. It seems, as I said to my announcement, it seems to me that between, I think, principally stock of a country and Lake Hayes Estate, which would probably be a principal example, we've got a really, really wide corridor across to IV3, for example. Isn't that such a wide corridor that from most viewpoints that would just eliminate that any context? To the point where they'd be seen as something, the pods would be seen as something completely different.
Can you, sorry, I probably haven't quite understood the question. If you could just explain that to me.
Yeah, instead, from a number of vantage points where the public can view this.
Yes.
They'll be viewing it across the conflicts of existing development on the North Bank.
Oh, that's only from within Lake Hayes Estate. And from the margins of State Highway 60, Lane's Mile. But that is the area also which offers the clearest views to RB3 in particular, but also RR2, apart from the cycleway and the Quay Trail.
Well, we talked about that, but even within those areas.
Yeah.
I'm a resident or a visitor in shot of the country, and I've got sick of being surrounded by medium density housing. I want to get some visual relief. And I've wandered down not far out of either of those places, and you're still looking across the river. And you don't have to get far out of either of those two developments, and you're still a long way from the river, and you're still in terms of hundreds of metres. And there's a lot of open country between you and the river, and then you've got the river corridor itself, and then you've got RD3 rearing up. So I'm sort of testing your concept of this sort of linkage through context.
But it's not just linkage through context. If I could take you to, I think the easiest thing for me to do is perhaps just to take you to one or two of the
photo supplements.
The supplements that I have, the annexures. And if I could take you to an annexure G, I think that might be useful. And that's if we go to the second image, which has photo point 45 on. In fact, on the previous page it's shown in a slightly more close-up form with 44. And if you look at those two,
the front page of G.
Sorry?
Sorry, just to clarify, the front page of G.
Yes, so if you go to that and then you turn over to the next one, you'll see an arrow with 45 on it on the map, on the aerial view. Sorry, it's right here, Commissioner.
Okay.
And it's referred to as photo location 45. Now,
I'm not finding it. Sorry for being stupid, I'm not finding it. Okay, I'll start it too. I think I'll leave it up here. Sorry, that one.
Now the point I was raising here is that yes, there are other views from Lake Hayes Estate that are contextualised by the residential development, particularly when you look in, for instance, from the open space that sits in the middle of Lake Hayes Estate. And when you look from that, you've got the power lines passing over your head, and you've got residential development either side of you, and it actually frames the open space. But I've deliberately taken you to Judge and Jury Place, which is, when I took this photo, was the most exposed vantage point that I could find without
without going to the cycleway and walkway trail. And this shows you the sort of view to both the upper and lower terraces of RV3. And you can clearly see those two terraces on the other side of the river at this point, at these points here and down here. And then to the left in the distance you can see part of RR2 as well. And that's roughly, if I can just show you where that is, that's roughly over here. Now the point I'm making is that if you're looking from these vantage points, your viewing plane is a very flat perspective. And one of the key factors from my point of view is what's going to happen, how are people going to see this development, how is it going to be contextualised, not just in the foreground but by the emerging vegetation that starts to unfold, particularly on the terrace fence between those two terraces, the upper and lower one. Also around the river margins, which you can clearly see, you can see the eroding banks there, just above, just to the right of the willows, or between the gap between the willows. And my feeling is that if the strategy that I've talked about is allowed to unfold, then yes, you will see some development. You'll see pockets of development. You'll also see quite large stands of vegetation or sweeps of vegetation across those terraces. It will start to climb above the lip of those terraces as well. And what's actually going to happen is that over time it's going to diminish the scale of any of that built development very appreciably. You're looking at it edge on. And so it's actually very difficult to get a clear view or get any real sense of the development that would occur on those terraces as a whole from these sorts of vantage points. Does that help explain that a little bit?
You're relying heavily on that, aren't you?
No, I'm not just relying on that. I'm also talking about the fact that because you're looking across to those terraces, and those terraces are relatively flat to gently sloping plane, what you're going to actually see is the edge of the development, but you won't see the development as a whole. It simply isn't possible.
Okay, the edges. Talk about edges.
Yes, well, edges, the edges...
As an example, not far away, of an edge development, which I think is appalling, and that's when you look up the river and see the edge of the Glenbrook Drive industrial estate and those buildings sitting at the top of the church.
I couldn't agree more. And that's exactly why, that's exactly why I have stressed both in my evidence, but we also, I think there has been at times a bit of a gap between what Mr. Sargent was attempting to do and what was in my mind and Rebecca Skidmore's mind about what should be unfolding there. But there has been absolutely no question in my mind from the moment we looked at the site that the terraces and the riverbanks need to all be revegetated. And their margins need to be revegetated. And development needs to be set back sufficiently that it provides breathing space between that development and both the escarpment edge and the river edge.
Yes, I did. The terraces and the river edges need to be revisited.
Yes, they do. And there needs to be enough of a setback so that there is breathing space established there. In reality, that's logical, simply because people, the place that will appeal perhaps most of all in terms of public open space will be those margins.
That isn't something that I divine from reading the provision.
No.
And yet a sketch or an addition to the structure plan and the narrows would have done the job.
Well, we tried to do that with H, but we realised that it was only so far we could take it. If I take you to H51, Mason and Wales produced this early conceptualised concept. And as you can see, what you end up with is development that's pulled back from, in fact, it's pulled back quite a long way from those edges. And from my point of view, that's simply a practical consideration. You don't want to place development right next to potentially eroding riverbank edges. But at the same time, it's also an area where you can locate your future trails, you can have some of your public open space. The people want to go there, they want to look up and down the river. So I think that those considerations are really important in terms of looking at any future application. But if we go back to my annexure G, the point I'm really making is that those edges aren't just going to be a solid line of built development. That in fact they're going to be development that's creeping up from the riverbanks and up from the terrace escarpment. There's going to be strips or areas of open space, we don't know what size at this stage. And then there'll be a second tier of planting that will occur within the development itself. And so we try to reflect that in some of those early photo models. They're not real montages, but we try to model that, and that's what we try to show. What happened though was when we put even a very low level of planting through the site, that it didn't take much planting to in fact start to obscure virtually everything that you see. And that's of course what you see when you go to like annexure H52 or 53. And you can see the photo points that those relate to. I took those photos and so we tried to marry those up to the SketchUp model that we had. And of course we were seeing so little development that I kept on saying make it brighter, because there's no way otherwise anybody would see anything. Now you can only take, you can look at those and you can only take those into account to a limited degree. But that's precisely why I think seeing everything on site is actually so important. And Ms. Melsop this morning talked about the limitations of photo simulations. Couldn't agree more with her. You know, there's no three-dimensional quality to simulations. You don't get a sense of movement, you don't get a sense of your own movement. In most cases, people are moving through, moving past or to or from these viewpoints. And that's particularly the case in relation to the cycleway and walkway trails. So you have to take all of those factors into account when you look at this sort of imagery. But the reality is that when you go to these photo points, you can see the very issue that I've raised. That in many such views, all you really see are the edge, and that edge is quite easily obscured. Now if we go over the page to look at photo point 46, that's even more apparent. Sorry, still in annexure G, photo point 46, photo location 46. So this is the large area of reserve and river terrace land and walkway cycleway connecting up with the main walkway cycleway. Now once you're into a location like this, you simply won't see anything on the other side of the river. But you'll still see the remarkables, of course. If we move over to photo location.
I'm relying on a large amount of existing planting on the north bank, don't you?
That's right. But the truth is, at the moment it's not going away, because what's actually happening is there's no longer any farming there. So there's no real constraint on the regeneration of that exotic planting. If we go over to photo location 47, again you see exactly what I've just been talking about. Yes, There's the River Terrace. The River Terrace in the distance below the barn. And the other farm building is clearly apparent. But the development on that upper terrace itself would be much less prominent, much less legible, once vegetation on the escarpment itself and within the development area had been given a chance to start to grow. If we go over to photo location 48, this is looking from the river's edge itself. And what you begin to realise is that the vertical scale of the actual river banks around that lower terrace actually are quite a significant impediment in their own right to see very much of what would occur on the river terrace.
Yeah, this gets, takes a good example of this particular photo where we started this discussion. We're exploring the notion of context.
Yes.
There's no North Bank context whatsoever there, is there? Or
no. And I'm sorry, I know I've taken us off the track of it, but it's an important, these are important discussions because the context is so variable. Now, if we go onto the next page, photo location 49, this is where you do have that more, a typical more elevated vantage point. And here you're looking across to towards RR, where RR 4, 3 and part of 2 would be visible. So if I just point out where that would be the case, you'd end up with RR4 down here.
Sorry, down to the...
Just to the left of the shelter belt.
That shelter belt, so that's RR4.
RR3 is just to the right of the shelter belt. And then RR2 is much further up this door. It's much further over. It's not the large area of flat green that you see there, it's actually above it.
Okay, so that terrace above it?
Yes.
And what's the green for?
The green area is too low lying.
Not being used.
No, it's not. Not developed at all. Now the next photo, the next image is photo location 50. This is where you look down on the existing farm buildings and farm manager's residence.
That's Owen Burn, that's right.
That's right, that's the Owen Burn Creek and its outwash area. And if you look at this, just to help locate everything, RV4, which might well be a lodge and landing for boats, is down right next to the river. You can see there's a cat shed there at the moment.
Before right down here?
Yes, right down the bottom.
The woolshed.
The woolshed, sorry. Trying to traverse a lot of territory very quickly.
Yeah.
And then if we move up to the area above the poplars, you're looking at RR6. And then to the right from where you are, to the right of the manager's house is another terrace, and that's RR5.
Isn't it the upper and lower there, RR5? Just looking at the scale of RR5, the upper terrace and the
area below
it.
Yes,
the
it is.
The
lower, yes, it's a
problem.
Yes.
Sorry, I was trying to look at it from upside down. It was a bit difficult. And then over to the right, you'll see again the pocket of our four that I referred you to before with the previous image. So that's right over on the extreme line. So context, in terms of context, but also just in terms of straight visibility, that sort of takes you through some of the most exposed parts of the areas we see the greatest exposure. But the thing that these photos don't capture, and it's quite obvious just looking at them, is that they don't capture most of the remarkables. And so you'd lose a sense of the sheer scale and grandeur of the remarkables rising up above the river valley. And unfortunately, this is where we get into the limitations that photography imposes on all of us, and a sort of surrogate for actually being at these or visiting these locations. And it's also where you see the quite marked contrast between those areas that are more defined by the farming that has been undertaken on them, lower down closer to the river, and those areas that are more roughly hewn out of the sort of mountain range which rises up above. The area where you start to get the transition into Madagauri and Spaniard and first rough pasture and then tussock grass and so on. So the photos just aren't capable of capturing all of that.
When you talk about farming, leaf farming is open. The vegetation might be different, but it's not covered with buildings. Is that sort of more acceptable to the eyes?
I think what it does is probably reveal more of the terrain. The flip side is, and this is where it gets quite difficult in terms of interpreting things like naturalness and so on, is that once upon a time it would have been, and not so long ago, a lot of this would have been forest land, framing the more subalpine and alpine areas above. And in fact, you still see those patterns once you get away from this part of Wakatipu. Once you get up into the margins of like the Dark River, you get into parts of the Matukituki River. So when you start to see those patterns, those natural patterns re-emerging, here what we have is a landscape that has essentially been created by human action or human interaction with the sort of natural structure provided by both the river and the mountains.
Can you ask any more questions?
Just in terms of all the witnesses, I'm a witness for today, and the way we've got people coming in and leaving is there's about six or seven, but tomorrow, optimistically, we think we might get to a Tuesday, Wednesday.
I'm sure we'll get through it. This ground requires a bit of time.
but we may finish a little bit, just to make sure that we're out of at 3:30, 4 o'clock tomorrow, that doesn't cause you a difficulty. Thanks.
So, I'll adjourn until 3:30.
Thanks.